Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Don't let the theme music give you false illusions or ideas that this show is back in full force. I've merely decided to go at it part-time. Shows that will relate around a speaker that's coming to the city or an event that's going on that just has to get out there. But for today, we're going to be listening to John Ralston Saul. Why? Because he's the greatest thinker we have of our time. And two, he's in town Thursday.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Today's show features John Ralston Saul talking from TVO's Big Ideas series about his most recent book at that time, The Collapse of Globalism and the Reinvention of the World. In this discussion, he confronts the reigning economic ideology known as globalization. And far from being an inevitable force, Saul believes globalization is already breaking up into contradictory pieces. Citizens are reasserting their national interests in both positive and destructive ways. John Ralston Saul is Canada's most prolific prophet and thinker of our time. He has written many books, essays, and novels, but you might be surprised to find out that he's involved with many other activities. He is the co-chair of the Institute for Canadian Citizenship. He is a patron and former president of the Canadian Center of International Pen. He is also founder and honorary chief of French for the Future. He is the chair of the Project Advisors Committee for Evergreen at Brickworks in Toronto. He's also a distinguished patron of the Canadian Academy of Independent Scholars and a patron of PLAN, P-L-A-N, a cutting-edge organization tied to people with disabilities. He's involved with Engineers Without Borders and the Canadian Landmine Foundation. There are many other activities. This man is so busy, it's a wonder he manages to find time to write anything, but it does give him a wide overview of life, philosophy, and especially economics, as we'll hear in today's show. John Ralston Saul is here in Hamilton this coming Thursday, December the 4th, at the Hamilton Central Library. His talk starts at 7 p.m. They are asking for $5 at the door, and he has been brought here to us by the lovely folks from Brian Prince Bookstore. That's the lovely independent bookstore located at Sterling Street and King Street intersection. That's where you can pick up a copy of John Ralston Saul's newest book, A Fair Country, Telling the Truth About Canada. And now, here is John Ralston Saul.
I've been asked to give the Snyder Lecture. It's a great honor. Thank you very much. And to give it on a topic I've been thinking about seriously and consciously since 1999, which is the end of globalism. And what happens, and how did it come about, and how did it come about without anybody except me noticing? Does it mean that I'm crazy, or simply that I do what I try to do in life, which is to notice things? That's what writers are supposed to do. I rethought how I could talk to you about globalization. The first time I ever had any kind of public conversation about it was in Sydney, in a theater in front of about 1,000 people on national television live, and about halfway through the lecture, which was on another topic, I heard myself segueing into a line which went something like, "And you know, I think globalization is dead or dying." And then I thought, my God, what did I just say? And, you know, what do I say next, really? But in a sense, I'd begun to feel that something was happening that nobody was writing about or talking about. That was 1999, 8 years later. I think we've moved a long way down that road out of the era of globalization. And what that means is that although a few more people are saying it in different ways here and there, it's actually being said now, it's still a pretty small group who have noticed something. And most people who are what you might call in the functioning elite, politicians, civil servants, business leaders, journalists, consultants, lobbyists, and so on, speechwriters, they're still locked up in the discourse of the last quarter century, the discourse of globalization. And what that means is that there's an incredible disconnect between reality, what's actually happening, and elite discourse, what people who get time like this are actually saying. That what they're saying has less and less to do with what's actually happening. It's not actually a debate about whether you're for or against globalization. It's, you know, that's almost an irrelevant debate at this point. It's actually people talking about the world working one way, but in fact the world is doing something else. One of the signs of that is that there is still a discourse around globalization, even among those who oppose it, that it's going to happen no matter what you do anyway, so it's just a question of whether one can improve it a little bit. So even somebody like Stiglitz, if you actually listen to what he's saying, he's sort of saying, well, I'm against this, and this, but it's happening anyway, so can we reform it a little bit? How can we make it work a little bit better? So what that means is that even the opponents actually are accepting that the fundamental assumptions of globalization are true and are happening. And I'm saying something completely different, which is that the fundamental assumptions never were inevitable, and most of them aren't actually happening. But what this means is that the broad assumptions of the way the world works have hardly changed in 25 to 35 years. Very old hat. But when you start looking at the details of what's happening, you find that it's very different from the broad assumptions. The first assumption that I want to deal with is one that has to do with universities, and that's economics. I would say that about somewhere between 80 and 95% of professors of economics in the Western world teach the same theory. There's an astonishing assumption about how economics works and that truth has been found, and we're just arguing about the details around the edges of economics, that somehow a breakthrough has been made to a monolithic view of how you do economics. And there are some people who don't agree. There's about 15%, 5, 10, 15% who don't agree. The interesting thing about this is that this is the final delusionary stage of social sciences. We actually think that a highly speculative area of debate, and in the whole of the social sciences, the most speculative area is economics, that this highly speculative area is actually a science. In it being a science, you actually have facts which have led to answers. Now, I actually don't know any scientists who talk that way. I don't know any physicists or chemists who think they have the truth. The only people in the universities I know who are pretty well convinced they've got the truth are the economists and, if you like, their lapdogs, the business school management team. Right? And it's a very odd thing that nobody says, wait a minute, you know, go through all of the schools of thought which get Nobel Prizes. Do any of them talk about facts and truth? No. Only the economists believe that they've worked the thing out and that there is one school which ought to dominate. So in fact, economics is this very, very interesting speculative area. Secondly, it's not an area which has progressed a great deal. Yeah, I mean, of course, we've made some real breakthroughs, some of them relating to technology, some of them relating to information. There have been some breakthroughs. But fundamentally, there are, I don't know, 4 to 6 ideas in economics, fundamental ideas. And if you look at history over the last couple of thousand years, we basically just go around and around and around. And it's not that they neatly take turns, although that does happen. What tends to happen is that some combination of the 4 to 6 ideas takes power, and then as it dissolves, some new combination takes power. It's rarely one, but sometimes it's one form in its purity, or it's declared to be one of the 4, let's say 5 basic ideas. But actually, it's a sort of revolving door, and they just keep coming back, described each time as being brand new. Of course, you know, we've made a brand new discovery, we have a new way, this is the truth, this is the way it must and will be done. What usually happens is there's some sort of political economic idea in place. It wins power. It becomes the truth of the day. If it's economically dominated, it gradually removes the competing ideas. It lasts for 30 to 50 years. And then gradually, as the fact that it isn't the truth emerges because it doesn't work the way it's supposed to work. It sort of works, but it doesn't work the way it's supposed to work. So it gradually starts to unravel. And as it unravels, we slip into a period that is in reality a period of uncertainty, a sort of vacuum between one period's ended, the next period hasn't begun. We're in an in-between period, of a vacuum, except it's a very confused vacuum filled with competing forces trying to decide what the next period will look like. If you don't recognize that you're in the vacuum, if you go on pretending you're in the previous period, then of course you're very badly prepared to deal with how to get out of the vacuum into some reasonable new period. What happens next will be imposed on you instead of you shaping the future. Next point, the reason you get this slippage between public discourse and reality, where you have an elite that goes on talking as if globalization were still just bubbling along when in reality something else is happening, so completely out of sync with what's with the world. The reason that happens is, of course, that elites in democracies or dictatorships, elites are produced by their time. And why? By the time you've been about 20-odd years in a period, in an era, everybody who's in power has basically been produced by that era, by the assumptions of that era, the assumptions in the universities, the assumptions in the bureaucracies, in the businesses, and so on. And by the time you get to about 25 or 30 years, now you've got people who are in the top, say, 15% of the power structure, public, private, university, whatever, who have never known any other possibility of how to do things. In fact, their whole career is the product of, in this case, the globalist era. You know, you became a CEO or a deputy minister or a tenured professor, a bank president, by buying into the truth and working with it. You are its representative, in a sense. And so you end up being a little bit, I don't know, you know, Agincourt. You know, the battle in which the flower, the most brilliant people who had the truth of the day, the French aristocracy, got into their fantastic armor with their fantastic lances and their fantastic swords in lovely colors and, you know, got on their fantastic horses and rode out in perfect formation based on a series of assumptions about how battle was done. They were unbeatable. They had the truth. Of course, what they hadn't noted was that on the other side, there were these really, really uncouth little Englishmen, you know, who weren't really interested in the proper, truthful way of fighting a battle, and therefore, the people with good accents were on horses, but the people with bad accents were on foot with little daggers, and they ran around and stuck their daggers in the bellies of the horses, and the horses fell over and died, and then they hacked the heads off the brilliant knights. Right, and meanwhile, a lower middle class of yeomen had longbows, which was also breaking the rules. But because the French knights, who were the exact equivalent of a Harvard MBA today, right, the French knights were out of touch with reality. They simply couldn't understand what would happen on the ground until they were lying on it and being killed. Very much like today. So that kind of disconnect is perfectly logical. And of course, the more the elite senses that although they have power, it isn't working out the way they thought it would, the more nervous they become. They can't admit it, that they don't really control the way things are going. So they become, as they become more disconnected, so they become more fearful. And specifically about Canada, this has been, I think, this is particularly dangerous for this country because, in a sense, you know, we're a medium-sized country, not small, a medium-sized country next to a gigantic country. And so to have an elite which is out of touch with reality is very dangerous. You know, enormous power can go quite a long time on the basis of established wealth. But a medium-sized power, a small power, you can't be smarter than anyone else. You have to learn how to pretend that you're smarter. You have to be more conscious. You have to be more applied. You have to actually know what reality is. And that allows you to do better when the others who are bigger than you are sliding about in a sense of your reality. And we, in effect, are doing worse because our elite are truer believers in globalization than our neighbors to the south, who don't really believe in it very much at all. And they keep saying, well, we have to hold on to globalization, otherwise we're in real trouble versus the United States. But if the United States doesn't believe, and you insist on believing, you're actually exposing yourself to you know, the man on the ground with a little nasty knife, which is precisely what happened to our beef industry, and it's precisely what happened to our pulp and paper industry, or rather our timber industry. That we were insisting that there was a certain way of doing things, and it in fact cost us an enormous amount of money and weakened us at the international level. And I think a very specific point is that the last 50 years has seen the rise of the management schools, and I've written at length about how, you know, the simplest thing would be just to close them down, but because, of course, you know, an era that declared itself to be the era of capitalism has spent more money on producing managers than on producing anything else. Guess what? A manager is not a capitalist. A manager is a manager. A capitalist is a capitalist. A capitalist owns something and loves risk. An innovation, an imagination, living by on the edge. A manager is somebody who is interested in structural calm and expansion through structure. Now, this, the United States is so big that it can afford to expand its managerial team. This country can't afford to have its functioning elite dominated by managerial theory, because it renders us, it takes away our sense of the possibility of action. It immobilizes us, and I think a lot of what is inexplicable about the incapacity of our elite to do things comes from the fact that we have put far too much effort into producing competent managers, when in fact it is we needed that kind of edginess which has always been a characteristic of this country. The next point is, what are, I say there are four or five ideas or six ideas around economics. So what is the philosophical, economic history basis of globalism? Well, it basically has two roots, two homes. Interesting for a new global idea, both of them come out of 19th century Britain. Doesn't sound terribly global or new. The first one is the free trade idea, which of course comes out of mid-19th century Midlands Britain, second-tier industrial revolution stuff. Interesting thing about the free trade theory is the free trade theory was essentially attached to a pro-democratic, pro-public good idea. And then the other fundamental idea that lies at the roots of globalism is the great enemy of free trade, which is buccaneer capitalism, 19th century Britain, and then 19th century United States, France, Germany, and so on. And 19th century buccaneer capitalism, you found it at its height in the beginning of the 19th century and the end of the 19th century. And of course, buccaneer capitalism, there are other ways of describing it, was fundamentally anti-democratic and against the social, the public good. So the brilliance of the theorists of the 1950s and 60s who put together the theories of globalization was they took the two great enemies of 19th century economic theory and glued them together. So it is brilliant. Unfortunately, they were contradictory, totally contradictory, because one's pro-democratic, the other's anti-democratic, one's pro-public policy, the other's anti-public policy, and one has an idea of a fair natural balance, and the other has an idea of the winner takes all. So that when globalism started to fall apart, it was almost certain, if you wanted to watch it falling apart, what you had to do was you had to look for that fault line, and the fault line was where those two schools had been glued together. And that is indeed the line upon which it's come apart. The next point is, I think that in order to understand what's going on today, and this is what I'm trying to do, there's a desperate need for us to draw back from the statistics, draw back from the truths of economic theory, and try to get a look at what's going on. Take that distance to say, well, what is actually happening in this study? Every time we say, but that's happening, they say, well, that's just an exception to the rule. But actually, globalism is inevitable. Draw back and see what is the shape of what's happening. And I'm going to give you a single introductory example of that. There are various trade rounds, right? The next trade round that hasn't been happening is called the Doha round. And the theory on the right is that it's frightening because it will destroy the agricultural industries of the West by taking away the subsidies. The theory on the left and in the developing world, the developing economies, is that the Doha Round would be great because it would allow the agricultural economies of, say, Africa to get into the world business of agriculture without the disadvantage of fighting against subsidized American and European farmers, right? That's summarized pretty fairly, the arguments, I think. Shout out if I'm not, but I think that's pretty fair. Well, of course, all of that argument about Doha is based on assumptions which are wrong. I believe that if Doha were to succeed, the farmers of the developing world would be the victims of it. Why? Well, for a very, very simple reason. And that is because the economic theories of the 19th century tied to globalism were all constructed in a time of scarcity. There weren't enough shoes. I'm just looking out here. You know, there weren't enough running shoes. I mean, there weren't enough shirts. There, a lot of this stuff there wasn't at all. But there wasn't enough food. The whole free trade in the middle of the 19th century in Britain was about grain. And there wasn't enough grain. And the grain was too expensive. And how could you make the grain cheaper? Today, we have an agricultural surplus around the world. I mean, there are people starving, but that has to do with ownership and transportation and distribution. We're in a massive surplus situation. And what happens in a massive surplus situation is that the producers lose, and the money goes to the people who control the products because they get to control the markets. So when you actually look at the numbers in agriculture, it's very clear. I mean, there's no disagreement about this. What you see is that farmers' income has been going down, prices are going down, and so the farmers, it's virtually impossible to make a living as a farmer anymore, whether you're subsidized or not. The prices are going down, and interestingly enough, the middlemen's incomes are going up. And what that is a sign of, when the middleman's income goes up, when the incomes of the producers go down, what you're looking at is a surplus. And when you're looking at a surplus situation, any form of unleashed competition will drive the prices further down. So the Doha Round is absolutely the wrong thing to do. Next introductory point. If globalism is going to be a useful term, it actually has to mean something. What happens when something's been in power for a quarter century, 30 years, 40 years, and it starts not to work as well, is people become vaguer and vaguer and vaguer about what the thing means. So isn't it wonderful, you know, the kids, middle-class kids, are having a gap year between school and university or undergraduate, postgraduate, and they're traveling around the world. Isn't globalization wonderful? What's that got to do with globalization? You know, richer people have always traveled around. That's what the Grand Tour was in the 18th century in Europe. It's got nothing to do with globalization. I mean, it's almost as if fusion food is an example of globalization. The other day, the Financial Times of London had a big review saying how wonderful globalization was, and then they said, and the most important thing about globalization has been immigration. Well, I'm in favor of immigration, but it has nothing to do with globalization. It has to do with the end of empires and the decline in the size of the Western family and a couple of other things. It has nothing to do with theories of trade policy. Right? But we're entered into this period where the word globalization is now being used to replace the word international. Well, if that's the case, it doesn't mean anything at all. If all globalization means is now when we want to say international, we say globalization, well, then I think it's working in an interesting way and there's nothing to discuss because it's so vague and so undefined. Where would one begin? Which part of internationalism are you in favor of? Which part are you against? Either it means something or it means nothing. And, of course, it does mean something, as the professor said in his introduction, in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. If you go back and read those tens of thousands of incredibly boring economic papers that were written on the subject and the books and the speeches, it was very clearly laid out that what was happening, which was quite revolutionary, this was the revolutionary point, was that economics, for virtually the first time in history, was going to be taken from the second or third level of importance in civilization and promoted to the number one spot. And that from now on, forever inevitably, we would be looking at civilization through the prism of economics. So culture would be judged through the WTO. Everything would be judged. We would start talking about citizens as clients. mean, that was when you knew you were heading into the lunacy phase of this theory, you know, that sick people were clients. No, they're not. They're sick people, right? They're citizens who are sick. They're not clients. They're not here to make a purchase, nor is the intent to have a profit come out of this, you know. Now, let me just give you 20-odd random examples, but I think strategic examples of what I think is actually happening, which indicates where we're actually, perhaps, going. And this isn't about blaming globalization. Some things are working, some things aren't, but other things are happening, which indicates that globalism is no longer the dominant theory. And nor am I suggesting by mentioning crises that there were no crises before. There are always crises. The question during a crisis is there an assumption that the system in place can handle it or not? 15 years ago, the assumption was globalism could handle it. Today, there's a sort of sense of disquiet that things aren't going particularly well when there's a crisis. So, one, I'll just take a little bit by countries. You know, the United Kingdom, origin of these ideas. Last year, the Foreign Office announced the new priorities of UK foreign policy. There are eight of them. Counterterrorism, combating illegal immigration, drug trafficking and other international crimes, conflict resolution, something that I don't remember that isn't very important, UK economic interests. Now, that sounds like globalism, except you notice it's UK economic interests. It's not trade negotiations to lower barriers. It's an old-fashioned UK economic interest, which is an old-fashioned protectionist discourse. And then the last one, the six, five and seven, I can't remember, but the last one is UK security. So out of the eight, six of them are nationalist, defensive, and fear-laden. This isn't my opinion. This is their foreign policy. And this is supposed to be one of the two or three leading countries in globalization. This is a country also that believed, you know, anti-constitution, anti-charter of rights or bill of rights, believes in a kind of common sense approach towards individualism where you don't really know who other people are. That's why you don't talk to them too much. It's sort of a joke. They go into globalization, which is supposed to be about taking walls down, and they're coming out of it with the most strictly regulated identity card of any of the Western countries. They're going to have an identity card which is stricter than the French or the Spanish, right? With more information available to the authorities than under any of the other European countries' methods of security cards. And the other interesting little detail, which is London, came out of the IRA, if you like, and technology. London is now the most spied upon city in the Western world. 20 countries. The most spied upon city is London. Cameras everywhere, watching, recording. They're now leading the world in developing computer programs that will interpret the actions of citizens. So, for example, outside of banks, they put in programs that will interpret whether or not someone coming to the bank is going to rob it or not. You know, which is interesting because, of course, it might be somebody who's having an illicit affair with somebody who works at the bank, and I don't know whether there's really a big difference. You know, in the, you know, but there's this sort of George Orwellian idea about how through technology you're going to control the movement and the actions of people. Fascinating. United States, the next presidential election, there will be no pro-globalist candidate in any party. All candidates will be against globalization. Interesting. The last election, the midterm election, Democrats took the Congress on an anti-globalist argument. 42 newly elected members, 39 of them, in other words, the people who control the majority, 39 of them, of the 42 elected, were interviewed in depth and said they would not be supporting new trade legislation and so on because they were elected on a anti-globalist policy. This is reality. This isn't me making this up. This is actually what's happening out there in the world. China, you know, you've been hearing endlessly about how isn't it fabulous that China's come into globalization and so on. Well, first of all, you, of course, heard about the 2.5 seconds that it took for Yahoo and Google and so on to agree to the Chinese government's request that they censor themselves. Well, maybe it was 1.5 seconds that it took them. They resisted so heartily, thereby reminding you of the fact that technology doesn't have a global purpose. That actually technology increasingly is being used, the London example, the Chinese example, and will be increasingly used to put up walls, not to take down walls. Because authorities, and commercial interests are learning more and more how to use technology. Some of it's fantastic. For example, the European Commission is learning how to control money markets in a way they've never been controlled before by putting speed bumps and corners into the way in which people buy and sell bonds. China, an era of great nationalism. Its international agreements increasingly are about signing bilateral fixed agreements for commodities, bilateral fixed agreements with Latin American countries and African countries for coal or copper, whatever it is. A fixed bilateral agreement is not a modern capitalist tool. It's an old-fashioned 19th century approach towards economic trade, which is you fix it so that the market can't intervene. Very interesting. They've just announced a new five-year plan. In China, five-year plans matter, you know. And a five-year plan is basically an anti-globalist plan. And it basically is saying, look, we know we've done quite well out of selling all this cheap stuff to the West because they seem to want to buy it. We know, however, that unfortunately we cannot make this system, this basically 19th century industrial system, work for the whole of China. They've got a big crisis in the countryside. They know it won't work because they have an enormous environmental crisis, and they can't expand any further, really, along this classic industrial road. So they're trying to think up something new. And this five-year plan is filled with thinking about another direction they can take, and it's headed by something called, more or less, the five equilibriums, the policy of five equilibriums. And the five equilibriums are, if you watch the columns as well, domestic versus international, interior versus the coast is where the industrial stuff is, rural versus urban, society versus the economy, and nature versus, you know, unbridled human self-interest. And the instruction is that all authorities are to favor the interior, humanist, rural side against the international, globalist, free market side. Those are the instructions. So a couple of months ago, they fired the strongman of Shanghai. I don't know if you followed that or not, Mr. Chen. Western papers said he was fired because he was corrupt and because Beijing wanted more power over Shanghai. Probably both true, but that's what the Western papers said. What the Eastern papers said, Eastern world, said was he was fired because he wasn't following the new five-year plan. He was insisting upon the old globalist approach, so they got rid of him. India, you know, if you read only our papers and magazines, you would have to assume that the gigantic country of India, with its enormous population, only had one city in it called Bangalore, you know, where they do high tech. And that's India. And of course, why not? I mean, I'm not criticizing Bangalore. But the reality is, and these are their numbers, in the last 10 odd years, they produced about 1 million jobs. Which are what you might call globalist jobs, which would have been great in Saskatchewan, you know, and really fabulous, actually, or even in Ontario. Unfortunately, 8 million people arrive fresh on the job market every year in India. So that's 80 million new people on the job market, and only 1 million of them is globalist. The other 79 million are somehow to do with the interior. And the reality of that is, of course, the astonishing agricultural crisis that's taking place in India, which is so bad that they have suicide levels coming out of debt levels, which are terrifying. Talked about every day in India, reported on once every 3 months in the West. Again, tied to the fact that there is a surplus, that Indian peasants 20 years ago owned about, on average, about 5 acres. It's down to 1.8. And they can't live off that little land. So following the globalist industrial model, they were encouraged to buy smart seeds, you know, sort of Monsanto seeds, and which are more expensive. In order to buy them, they had to borrow money, and it only took one bad year for them to fall into debt, after which there's a spiral downwards, which has led to this kind of crisis. And all of it turns around the fact that you're in a surplus situation and that they cannot possibly succeed inside this model. There has to be another model. Interesting enough, the Asian Development Bank has just lent India, the Indian farming community, $1 billion to get them out of debt. But you see, again, it's like Doha. It's get them out of debt so they can buy more Monsanto seeds to go back into debt. as opposed to get them out of debt and kill themselves. Get them out of debt so that they can actually go at it differently, which is to say move out of the idea of global trade, move into a much more local approach, use many more cooperatives. In the south of India, in the dairy industry, they're using a cooperative approach, and they're now actually making money because it's a kind of semi-controlled system with landowners, and it's actually working to some extent for them. Last year, about a year, year and a half ago, in Paris, a treaty was signed, or the agreement that leads up to a treaty was signed, called the Cultural Exception Treaty. This is one of the most important things that's happened in a quarter century. The whole of the cultural area was removed from the WTO and from NAFTA, from the trade agreements, and put in its own area. It was basically agreed among pretty well every country in the world except the United States and maybe one or two others that culture existed in its own right, not simply through commerce. Now, I mean, that's hardly rocket science, but it means you'll remember that Canada was dragged before, I think it was NAFTA commissions over our subsidies of magazines, and we were found guilty. This will no longer be possible once this is a treaty. It's extremely important, which is why you've never heard of it. I mean, the Anglophone press has not talked about this at all, which is very problematic because this is the first formal identification of the fact that the answer to the difficulties of globalization is not to put more and more power, humanizing power, into the WTO, but rather to take things out of the WTO and create alternate centers of power where economics is not the leading force. Intellectual property, you know, sounds so boring, right? Intellectual property. It was right at that sort of point of where the two theories were glued together. When the WTO was created, even the pro-globalization people like Bagwati said, if you put intellectual property in here, it was the lobbyists of the pharmaceutical companies and so on that got it in there, if you put it in here, it will break the WTO apart, it will undermine globalization. They put it in there, and that's what's happening. The first country to actually demonstrate that they couldn't enforce it, that it couldn't work, was Brazil, giving out free AIDS drugs. They were going to be dragged before courts and all the rest of it, and in the end, nobody did anything to them. The result is they actually have the AIDS crisis, not under control, but almost under control. November of last year, Thailand, a medium-sized country, small to medium-sized country, introduced what they call compulsory licensing for key AIDS drugs. In other words, they're getting key AIDS drugs made cheap in India, and they're going to give them out free in Thailand. Editorials all over the Western world saying, now, Thailand, you be careful, or we'll, you know, we're not going to have any effect at all. They're going to do exactly what they want. And I would predict that intellectual property will somehow be removed from the international system fairly fast. About 6 months ago, the European Union, the most powerful trade body in the world, 300 million people, much richer than the United States because the United States has a big poor part of the population, whereas Europe is essentially middle class, right? So on a per capita basis, a much richer place. EU formally announced that it was abandoning the classic globalist trade policies, the broad free trade policies, and would be concentrating on much more modest, narrow bilateral agreements. November 2006, a worldwide survey of leading CEOs, corporations, the majority believed that protectionism is rising in both developed countries and developing countries. Latin America, I mean, do a continent in about five sentences. I mean, you know, Latin America has basically, the Panama Canal, more or less, you know, cut free and gone off in another direction. I mean, there are populists, there are socialists, there are people thinking about new ways of doing economics. There's all sorts of things happening. Nobody in Latin America believes in globalism anymore. They're going in another direction. Does that mean they don't want to sell or buy anything? Of course not. We've always sold and bought things. It means they don't believe in globalism. And they're going to do something else. And some of it's regional, some of it's national, some of it's international, some of it's with China. But it's not globalization. Will it work? I have absolutely no idea. What I know is that it's lasting a lot longer than one would have expected. In the old days, as a friend of mine in an American magazine said, God, by now we'd have had three or four coups d'etats we'd have organized, you know. And, you know, there haven't been any. The regimes are not falling. Maybe they'll fall, but they haven't fallen. And actually, Argentina is doing really surprisingly well, considering, you know, past history and so on. We're seeing rising populism, which is not a good thing, throughout the world. Inside the EU, all through Central Europe, populist governments, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary. This is not a good thing. We haven't seen this since the 1930s. People say, well, there are spikes of populism, and then it goes down. Yes, it's true, it does go like this. But if you actually look at the line, it's going like that. In other words, populism is generally rising. How far will it go? I frankly have no idea. But an interesting example outside of Europe, Japan. If you look at Trace Japan over the last 10 years, the return of nationalism in Japan. Now, I mean, you know, Japan never really took down the walls. But there was a discourse that suggested it knew that it had to take them down. But gradually, particularly over the last 5 years, it's been moving in a more and more nationalist direction. The new prime minister is overtly nationalistic. Not anti-democratic, nationalistic. He's openly saying, as opposed to quietly saying, that state policy will dominate over economics. You say, well, why is that? How is this happening? Well, it's pretty simple. In the globalist era, the economic structure of Japan changed. At the beginning of the globalist era, about an eighth of Japanese had no savings. Today, a quarter of Japanese have no savings. Before globalization, they asked them every year, about 75% of Japanese considered themselves middle class. Today, that's down to 54%. And it's amazing, 37% of Japanese consider themselves to belong to the poor, the lumpen proletariat. And this is, you know, so what does that lead to? It leads to nationalism. It leads to a desire, a lack of belief in the globalist project. Military budgets. This year, they're at about $1.2 trillion, which means we're back up over Cold War levels. This means economics is not dominating. And over half of that is spent by the United States, six times Russia, six times China, in spite of what you're hearing about Russia and China ramping up. And what's fascinating is that of this $1.2 trillion, and there I would have to guess, I would say that maybe $200 million is being spent on irregular warfare, machinery, anti-terrorism machinery. Really, almost a trillion of it is being spent on old-fashioned big stuff. Suddenly, you remember economic nationalism, we won't sell our corporations to foreigners. Suddenly, the United States won't sell its ports to people from the United Arab Emirates. The French won't sell big energy companies to, I believe it was the Germans. The Spanish won't sell companies to, I believe it was the Italians, and so on and so on. Only Canada naively goes on believing that it's all open. You just sell them and buy them, you know. And besides, we're buying as much as we're selling, and you hear that quite often when you're being reassured. Let me just give you the numbers. 30% of corporate revenue in Canada is controlled by foreigners, and 6% of corporate revenue in the United States is controlled by foreigners, which is, you know, somewhere between 5 and 15% is a fairly healthy level. So we're very, very naive, asleep at the switch, when it comes to understanding what the Europeans are saying, our competitors, what the Australians, New Zealanders are saying, what the Chinese are saying, what the Indians are saying, and what the Americans are saying. And we're just asleep at the switch in understanding this. If you look at the trade balance for the last 20 years, I mean, we're in surplus, right? But if you actually look at the parts of the trade balance, what you find is, this is really boring, but it's not. Machinery and equipment was in deficit in the 80s, and it's just been going further and further into deficit. Automobiles went up a bit, but it's almost in deficit now. Consumer goods was in deficit. It's now deeply in deficit. Industry is shrinking and hovering around deficit. The only area which has grown in the full period of globalization is commodities, hewers of wood, drawers of water, or in this case, oil and gas. The two areas which have grown are forestry and energy. So after 25 years of globalization, Canada is more dependent on old-fashioned raw materials than we've been for a half a century. Two last examples, and it's really the big question. Has globalization led to a near era of capitalism? Or has it, as was promised, or has it led to something else? You may remember something called mercantilism. Mercantilism is what preceded capitalism, Hudson's Bay Company, British East India Company. What was mercantilism? Why was Adam Smith against mercantilism? Because they felt, in the late 18th century, that it didn't produce wealth. There was a lot of trade, remember all that trade? There's a lot of trade, but it didn't produce enough wealth. Why didn't it produce wealth? Because the mercantilist structure works this way. large transnational corporations, Hudson's Bay Company, right, 18th, 17th century, 19th century, which are horizontally integrated so that right from, say, trapping the beaver to a fashionable beaver hat, from the silkworm all the way through, all those borders, all those processes to the woman wearing the silk dress, nothing is bought or sold. It's all integrated. Of course, it may technically change companies, or it may technically be bought and sold, but there is no real market buying and selling of goods. So no wealth is created between production and sale. Horizontally integrated around the world, a transnational corporation. Does this sound vaguely familiar to you? Over half the trade in the world today takes place inside funnels, horizontal funnels, inside transnational corporations or between large corporations, so that no real wealth creation is taking place at buying and selling points around the world. And that's how you get an increase of 22 times in trade and a mediocre increase in the creation of wealth. It's not that the creation of wealth is supposed to equal the increase in trade. But when trade goes like that, wealth is supposed to go, you know, a third of the way up or something like that. And instead of that, it's just a little tiny bump. And that's one of the big explanations. It could be argued, and I don't know that I would argue it, that globalization may in fact have been the last era of capitalism, that we have actually gone full circle and ended up where we started in about 1760, back in mercantilism, all done under the name of competition and capitalism by companies that are run by technocrats and are frightened of competition and spend their time doing mergers and acquisitions in order to avoid the real marketplace. And that's the last point, which is mergers and acquisitions, dominant thing in the marketplace around the world. Is this about globalization? No. Is it about free markets? No. It's about reducing free markets. Is it about capitalism? No. Is it subject to market rules? It's about reducing market competition. KPMG, right? Well-known communist organization, right? KPMG says 65% of initiators of mergers and acquisitions don't realize their synergy targets. McKinsey, that other Pinko organization, did a study of 100 mergers in the 1990s out of the UK and the USA. 75% did not recover their costs and did not achieve synergy. So if it doesn't work, which it doesn't, there are lots of the numbers like that, why do they do it? Is it simply that ego of the technocrats, of the managers? That's certainly part of it. They're terrified of risk, terrified of competition. But part of it is, I think, simply the return to mercantilism, the removal of competition, the removal of the free marketplace, under a discourse where they're supported by the universities, economics departments, a discourse of competition and deregulation. Actually, what you're seeing is an astonishing re-regulation at the international level, but a re-regulation not by the public good, but a re-regulation by an anti-capitalist group, mercantilist group, which is the large transnational corporations. So I think that it's time for a very broad economic debate where we rethink the underlying assumptions of the last 24 or 30 years before reality puts something in place that we may not agree with either. We should be looking at this differentiation between the growth in trade and the mediocre GDP. We should be looking at whether we're getting false growth numbers, in fact, because of the mercantilist approach. We should be looking at the questions of economic scarcity versus surplus and whether you need different theories when you're in surplus. We should be looking at the ideas of growth and consumption, and which was all of this was the point of writing this book, The Collapse of Globalism. Kind of have to look at the patterns of behavior, at the events, at the reality. The good story is that, you know, in 1996, the Ottawa Landmines Treaty was signed. That was the first serious international treaty with binding regulations, which almost all the countries in the world signed on to, except for about three or four, and you can guess. Which had nothing to do with economics. And it was a sign people were getting the courage back to do things that weren't through the eye of economics. 1998, the International Criminal Court, same thing. 2005, the Cultural Diversity Convention that I talked about. We still haven't done binding treaties on oligopolies and monopolies, i.e. mercantilism. We haven't done anything on competition. International treaties on taxation would be dead easy to do. I mean, if you can do a free trade agreement which describes every single thing in this room, everything you are wearing, everything here, everything is described in a trade treaty. It takes hundreds of pages, very complicated. It's dead easy to do an international agreement on taxation levels, which would deal with a lot of the problems of the lack of competition and price fixing and so on. And international agreements on work conditions, which have teeth, which would work for the developing world, not just for the West. International agreements on lobbyists and consultants, which is basically the same thing. You know, these are things that need to be done, which could shape the direction in which we're going in an interesting way. They would bring back the possibility of the idea of choice. Now, you'll just notice, I gave three examples of international non-economic binding treaties: landmines, criminal court, cultural diversity. It's interesting that all three of them were Canadian initiatives. I mean, how many of you in the room have ever thought that this is a country which says it's in favor of globalization, but in fact this is a country which has led the struggle to put in place the first three real non-economic choice agreements at the international level? How many of you have ever thought about that? I don't think our governments thought about it, and I don't think the last government thought about it. It's almost as if it were accidental that we were doing this. It's a very, very interesting thing to think about the kind of leadership that a country like Canada can have if it wants to do it, if it comes to terms with the fact that we're actually quite big and quite good at what we do when we set our mind to it. And I say this to you as a little last comment. This will sound like a non-wrap-up, but it is actually a wrap-up. I think one of the interesting things about this country is there are these examples of enormous successes. I think one could argue that our immigration and citizenship policies, flawed though they are, right, are an astonishing success story. It's the one thing the rest of the world is actually interested in when they talk about Canada, because on a per capita basis, we're 3 to 4 times further out on the experimental edge of what you can do with reinventing society than any other country in the world. And in brute numbers, we're actually number one, except vis-a-vis the United States, but they have 10 times the population, and we're not far behind them, which means it's an enormously inventive thing that we're trying to do on that front. And yet, you know, just think about it. We go out and we say, you get into Canada on a points basis, so you have to have credentials. So we bring them in with their credentials, and then as soon as they get in the country, we say, no, we were fooling, actually, not those credentials. Right? Total contradiction. I mean, somebody could actually take Canada to court for fraud, fraudulent advertising, on the basis of which we get people to come, and then once they get here, we actually say, no, not that, you know? We bring in 250,000, we swear in 250,000 new citizens a year. I'm in favor. I think this is fabulous, right? And at the same time, while we're doing that, we work hard at cutting all the programs in education we can that would help these new Canadians get involved as quickly as possible. We cut back on second language training. We cut back on soft education, which, of course, is, you know, things like history and culture, all the things that you need in order to become part of a society. I mean, it's irresponsible the way in which there is a total contradiction between what we want to do and what we're actively doing. Now, in spite of that, I think because Canadians want this to work, we're doing quite well. But the fact is we're not doing nearly as well as we could be doing if we were honest with ourselves. And just, you know, think about other small examples of what is it about our elite that it can't solve problems? I mean, it's a strategic question. What I'm talking about is what's happening in this vacuum is the people who will come well out of this vacuum are people who are able to identify reality and set directions, choices. And we have an elite, and when I say an elite, I mean government, opposition, civil service, federal, provincial, newspapers, business, consultants, the whole thing. We have an elite which actually doesn't seem to think of itself as being in the policy business, the choice business, the problem-solving business. So I give you that very simple example of why are we actually squeezing second language education when we're bringing in these levels of immigrants and new citizens? Why? It would take 2 seconds to deal with this problem. This is not rocket science, as they say. This is really easy. For now 30 years, we've been ramping up slowly, slowly a homeless crisis, a poverty crisis. It's really simple stuff. We know that over 50% of the homeless in Canada have mental problems. That's because we closed the mental bed, hospital beds in the 90s, because they weren't nice places. And we thought, unreasonably, that people would simply go and get pills or something like that. You know, line up and get pills. You know, complete misunderstanding of reality. So at the same time, we stopped building social housing. So there was nowhere for these people to go, assisted social housing. So over half the homeless people on the street really could be off the street within a year. For a very small amount of millions of dollars, it simply has to do with building small structures of assisted social housing where there's one person who helps them deal with their lives, and then they'll either be able to get jobs or not get jobs. I go into homeless shelters all the time, and I see mainly, in this case, men, healthy, intelligent, young men sleeping there who have jobs. Why are they sleeping there? Because the minimum wage is so low that they can't earn enough money, even though they're working their asses off, they can't earn enough money to put a down payment on an apartment. So the only way that they can actually have a life with that job is if they sleep in a homeless shelter. Is this rocket science? Is this complicated to solve this problem? I mean, it's really easy to deal with a problem like that. I'll give you two other examples. Obesity in schools. This is so easy, right? You know, it's a journalist sitting here, right? Millions and millions of words are written about the crisis of obesity in schools. The kids aren't doing enough exercise. They're eating all this junk food, and et cetera, et cetera. Isn't it interesting that we saved money by reducing sports in schools? And in order for the schools to make up for the money that was taken away from them, in order to get the programs, they did deals with junk food companies to serve junk food to the kids, for which they get about 50% of the profit. So, in other words, it's like people who eat foie gras. First we fatten the goose, and then we say, isn't it terrible? The Cabinet of Ontario, I mean, could meet tonight and ban junk food from schools, and it would be done tomorrow morning. That's true of every province in Canada. It's not rocket science. It's not a lot of money. And then they say, oh, well, the schools are dependent on the money they're getting from deals with Coke and whatever. So you ban it, and you replace the money. Is that the more expensive way of going or the cheaper way? Is it cheaper to have a crisis of obesity and then have all of that problem fall into our hospitals and our lack of productivity? Now, this is not complicated stuff. Why can't we do it? What prevents us from acting? And healthcare. You say, well, that's the beginning of a speech. You know, in the 1990s, two social scientists did a study in which they told the governments of Canada that we were going to have a surplus in doctors and nurses. They said, freeze or cut down on the number of doctors you produce. They did that. We have been frozen ever since. We have artificially created a shortage of doctors and nurses. This is the explanation for about 50% of the wait times and the problems in public health care. It has nothing to do with public health care. The problems with public health care largely have to do with a lack of hospital beds and a lack of doctors and nurses, artificially imposed limits which shove people into emergency wards, which create wait times and so on. So all I'm saying here really is that something is happening in the world. We're in a confused period. We're capable of doing remarkable things, witness those international treaties I was talking about, but somehow we can't imagine ourselves as being capable of doing amazing things. And that can be seen in these things like Medicare and obesity, sort of incapacity to act when acting is simple. And if you can't act at home, you're not going to be able to act in a strategic way at an international level. I believe that there is an enormous possibility of choice out here. I believe this is a country where people want to do interesting things, want to act, and I believe that the public good is something which belongs to you, and that it's therefore in your hands to say, no, we don't want to talk about obesity. We want you to ban junk food in schools. No, we don't want to talk about wait lines. We want you to increase the number of doctors and hospital beds, period. And we will vote against you if you don't do that. And we will vote for you if you do that. That's a strategic approach. And if we do that kind of thing, we'll find that within a very few number of years, we'll be taking a very interesting, conscious position at the international level to get us from this vacuum period into whatever the next period will be. Thank you very much.
On page 71 of his book, A Fair Country, John Ralston Saul sums it up by this statement I'd like to read to you now. The continued existence of homelessness and widespread poverty in Canada is all about selfishness. and public laziness hiding behind contract, that is, defining public instrumentalism in such a way that homelessness and poverty are said to be beyond action by the state. This is the single greatest dishonor to the crown today, a failure of our own civilization. On the environment, he says, the whole environmental area calls out for a new broad approach, one that rethinks how societies work. Instead, we have stuck to the narrowest possible bookkeeper approach to such things as global warming. Had we followed such a narrow and carefully written methods in the past in areas such as education and health, we would never have been able to embrace our imaginations and so take the great financial and social risks that produce public schools, public universities, and public health care. Something broader. Culture overwhelms the facts. Why? Because culture carries a greater truth than fact. A shift from oral to written, the poet and translator Robert Bringhurst has said, affects the functioning of memory, the understanding of truth, and the place of voice and language in the workings of the world. It affects not just the meaning of words, but the meaning of language itself. It affects the meaning of meaning. And my personal comment, in a day and age where everything is text-mailed or emailed with no tonality, no oral messages being passed back and forth, we lose so much in the translation and understanding of the words. We wildly reinterpret the message, and the misunderstanding grows. John Ronson Saul wants to have Canadians look towards the First Nations people of this country, of this nation, of this land, to learn how to be a Canadian. That's it for this show. See you in a couple of weeks.
Redefining Radio.
CFRU.